in 1863, which the date you mentioned when the Football Association was founded, and everyone sort of considers this was the dawn of soccer. In 1863, soccer had fair catches.
You're listening to The Brian D. O'Leary Show, your sanctuary for serious content in an unserious culture.
All right. Welcome back to The Brian D. O'Leary Show. We got Nick Green with us today. Nick has released a new book, May 12th, Abrams Press. It's called How to Watch Soccer Like a Genius and What Architects, Stuntwomen, Paleoanthropologists, and Computer Scientists Reveal About the World Game. Welcome, Nick.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
All right. Interesting timing with the World Cup on the horizon. Is that why you chose to write this and or release it at this?
Yeah. You know, I've loved soccer all my life, but the World Cup coming to North America certainly helped with deciding the timing of when this book would be written and come out.
Yeah. And you wrote a similar book a couple years ago. Basketball.
Yes.
About basketball.
Yes. Okay. Exactly. Same kind of conceit and framing of where I talk to experts in seemingly unrelated fields to get their perspective.
Yeah, and that's, I think, the first thing I wanted to talk about. Did you decide on these people first, or on these experts, or historical figures, historical concepts, or did you find something within each game and said, oh, maybe there is a little thread here I can pull?
That's interesting. Yeah, it starts basically with trying to track the history of the sport, and then, you know, the early history, how it developed, and certain things. As I research and write about those things, you know, things start to pop up. For example, with soccer, you know, I was looking for where to start, and I just thought, well, you know, the grass, start from the ground up. And that took me into a couple surprising directions of who I spoke with to talk about that. So I don't know going into it who necessarily I'm going to talk to. I have ideas, loose ideas of certain things that remind me of something maybe worth pursuing. But it's, you know, and again, I talk to lots of people who don't make it into the book, which is fun for me because I just have lots of interesting conversations with smart people.
Interesting concept. How did you come up with it? It you know, you don't see a whole lot of this where, you know, drawing from disparate topics or disparate thinkers. I mean, in the book, you're talking to some folks like, I don't even like soccer.
Yeah, no. And it's funny, people who don't like the sport will often have extremely valuable and illustrative insights to what makes the sport great, ironically. No, it's two things. The format was discovered largely by accident. I was working for Slate covering sports for them. And this was years ago. And it was during a LeBron James free agency period. And I thought it'd be funny because I got no real NBA sources. I thought it'd be funny to ask random experts in other fields as my sources of where LeBron was going to go. So I talked to astrophysicists and, you know, philosophers, that kind of thing. And in these conversations, I was having, you know, I was learning so much, just not just about the game or basketball, but I was learning about these people's lives and their work and what they do and how they helps them watch a game like basketball or soccer differently. And so I kind of followed that path and all the different paths. And that's just how my brain works too. I can't stay focused on one thing. I can't stay on a single. Yeah.
Yeah. It's called the cultural impact of the sports and how sports impacts the culture at large. Not necessarily, we talk about it a lot on you know, our podcast here and the stuff I write. I'm not interested necessarily in what happened in the Stanley Cup playoffs last night. I don't really care what happened in the Cubs game, for instance, the night before. You know, when I was seven, I was very interested and poured through the sports page every day to find that out. But now, as I get older and I see, you know, how sports impacts culture, I think that this was an interesting, interesting book to read. And I'm glad it came in front of me, because I told people I was interviewing you, Nick, and I'm like, man, you don't even like soccer. Like, what's going on? It's like, I do like soccer. I don't really appreciate the American kind of aping of European or particularly English hooligan culture when it comes to soccer. But the game's interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a kind of thing with, as you mentioned about cultural stuff. It's, I think the most, you know, the best part about sports is being able to talk to people about sports. You know, I think people who don't watch or aren't interested in sports are missing out because it's such a Rosetta Stone. I mean, if you watch sports and are interested in sports or are following sports, you can go to any bar in the world and have something to talk about with the person next to you. I mean, it's such a commonality. It's a common thing that we all kind of, not all of us, but those of us who do like sports have in common. And it's, you know, the nuts and bolts of who wins, who loses. Yeah, that kind of drives the day-to-day conversation of what's going on in sports. But gosh, it's such a fertile, you know, petri dish just to talk about anything.
Yeah, you mentioned Rosetta Stone, and I want to start, you more or less start the book out this way, the origins of the game.
Yeah.
And I've been working on history of college football a bit. And so the moment you talk about when the Football Association was founded in a tavern in London, and I read about this and I know about a lot of it. It so happens that college football, or what kind of what we know as college football, was codified. The first rules were codified a few months before the official soccer rules. And you get into like soccer and football and stuff. We'll call it soccer for the sake of our conversation. You have a big introduction there. But I thought that was real interesting because it essentially was the same game. Same game throughout continents. There's a ball, there's a couple goals, and we just go from there. And then, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, soccer, American football, rugby, all the same sport at one point, you know, in a way. And they branched, they were, you know, isolated and let to evolve and develop in their own sort of way. I mean, you look at soccer in 1863, which is the date you mentioned when the Football Association was founded, and everyone sort of considers this was the dawn of soccer. In 1863, soccer had fair catches.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that. I tweeted out, I said, I got this guy. He's going to hopefully talk about soccer having fair catches. Like, nobody would believe that. Touchdowns, too. Touchdowns, fair catches. Like, well, they had that in football. And like, so, you know, you had the codified rules, 1863, in the Freemasons Tavern in London. Some could argue it's maybe a Freemasonic conspiracy. So
yeah,
we're not going to go down that road. But anyhow, you have these rules, and what was there, like 19 rules? I want to say.
Something? Yeah, it's hard to say. I have a whole book of.
But they don't exist. They don't exist in college football anymore. Yeah. There's like two of them.
And the reason they codified the rules was basically because all these different young professionals had gone to schools like Eton and Rugby and very kind of posh, well-to-do, fancy schools, and they all played different field games. And some were more like what we called soccer today. Some were more like rugby, and some were, you know, also there's, you know, football elements of there too. And they realized, well, we want to get together and keep playing these games after we've graduated, but the rules, everyone's rules are so different. We need one single set of rules. And the Football Association did a terrible job of figuring out what those rules would be. They make no sense. I've gone over and you know, tracked every single annual meeting and the incremental meetings too, to see what they introduce and what they take away. It was a kind of a farcical joke of a organization.
They needed something written down so you could take from place to place and kind of a semblance of some sort of order. It's like when we all used to play on the playground at school, it's like, we're going to play soccer, but like, you know, no goalies today, or, you know, there's only five guys aside, or you get six or something like that. And then you can't take that from your playground. You transfer schools and go to another playground. It's like, no, the game is a new game literally every time you play it. And all sports, you know, we're getting to the point where like, we can't do this anymore. Our culture, you know, where travel is easier. We go from town to town, and it's, you know, so soccer did that. But then the interesting thing, I thought this was really neat point that you brought up. It's like, why hasn't soccer really changed after, you know, after a bunch of iterations, they finally got to the rules that more or less we know now with, you know, obviously there's some changes, but in the 1880s, there was the, was it the FA Cup? I want to say.
Yes. Yes.
And then they had the set of rules so people could play in a tournament. Now, college football never had that. You had to go from conference to conference or school to school and play the games. Baseball had a more or less codified rule thing in the United States at that time. But the reason, you argue anyway, that the reason it has not changed a whole lot over the years is because everybody bought into this code of rules, whether it's good or bad.
And everybody in different locations around the UK, they all had to start playing by the same set of rules because they had the FA Cup. And, you know, I talked to a lot of historians who know so much more about this than I do, obviously. And they point to the fact that rugby very purposely said, we don't need a cup. We don't want a cup contest. And that's the moment where soccer started spreading like wildfire and rugby, which, you know, obviously still popular, you know, was overtaken. It's because it got as many people playing by the same set of rules as possible. And at the same time, you also have the first ever international competitions, starting with England and Scotland playing each other. And then the spread, you know, goes worldwide, and right there, boom, everything's locked. The game is essentially locked from that point forward.
Yeah, let's talk about England and Scotland for a little bit. England started soccer, essentially.
Yeah, as we know it, yeah.
Football Association is soccer. Association football is soccer. And interesting, you say like, oh, why do they call it soccer? Well, it was used because you called a rugby guy. And then the SOC comes from association. I never knew that, but that's an interesting little tidbit. But anyway, we talk England and Scotland, and then Scotland beats England. And they're kind of crush England in most international competitions there for a while.
They dominate the first few decades, yeah.
Yeah, first few decades. And even though England invented the sport, we see this in baseball now. We see also every sport, basketball, you know, like, you know, U.S. was dominant until Russia started, you know, winning Olympic medals. And then Spain becomes great. And it's like, well, why U.S.? And I think about that every time the World Cup rolls around. It's like, England, why aren't you better? You invented the sport. But the point is that these other countries have their own style and tactics that they've developed. You know, England just gave you the framework. March on.
Yeah, and it's a brilliant illustration of you know, when an invention leaves the grasp of the inventor, and there's no telling what will happen with it. And with the story of Scotland is one of my favorite stories in all of sports. Is, you know, England for that first international game was, they were the heavy favorites. The English players were bigger, stronger, faster. They had a bigger talent pool to pull from. You know, it was supposed to be a walk in the park. But at the time, the way the English played was, you know, it was largely because of their upbringing, and these were, you know, wealthy aristocratic young men and who weren't used to sharing, and they would play, as one of the players said, purely for my own pleasure. They didn't pass. They said, you know, we're going to take turns just trying to dribble through everyone, and if I lose the ball, try to get the scraps, because I'm not passing to you. Whereas the Scottish were a bunch of normal dudes.
That's playground football. The best kid gets the ball. Or playground soccer. Yeah.
Yeah. 100%. And the Scottish were, you know, very, you know, different upbringings. They were just normal dudes. They had been playing with a very sort of free-flowing passing style. They shared the ball. They thought, oh, this is a good way to have possession progress up the pitch and move from one side to the next. And so you had these two combating styles. And the entire history of soccer tactics can be traced to that one game.
Okay, let's take a quick pause here. At the Brian D. O'Leary Show and on our Substack called Unrelenting, you know that we spend a lot of time fiercely defending American traditions. And often we're talking about sports when we do that. So what I appreciate here about Nick Green and his new book, How to Watch Soccer Like a Genius, is that he does to the world's game, so-called, what we do here. He refuses the sanitized, managed version of reality. He strips away the polish that the corporate press likes to put onto sports, and instead, he digs in to the chaotic, unvarnished truth of how the game of soccer actually works. Now, if you're tired of the engineered decline in our culture, our sports, and our economy, and you want to look at history with that same relentless critical eye, you need to step inside our private council. I want you to join the junto. I invite you to join the junto. That's what our paid tier is called. And by upgrading to a paid subscription to Unrelenting, the O'Leary Review, at $14.99 a month or $100 a year, you'll join us in our defense of the permanent things in our culture. You'll also get unrestricted access to our full vault of historical archives, premium dispatches on economics and patriotism, and become a part of an exclusive private community of unapologetic minds discussing the strategies we can use to take back this culture. But what we're really doing here is building enduring wealth. And that's not just money, mind you. And it's to gain independence outside of their rigged system. So if you're ready to draw blood and reverse the managed decline of our culture, head to the link in the show notes. It's O'LearyReview.com if you're just listening along or watching along. Head over there. Choose your level of commitment, whether it's unlocking the premium content or if you want to dive into our highly limited founding member tier with more access and higher level strategy. You can go enter the junto today. Once again, O'LearyReview.com. All right, let's get back to Nick Green. Yeah, and then you go into another explanation of soccer tactics. I thought this was really interesting. 1940s, I want to say, retired or Royal Air Force pilot, I think he was. He's into soccer, right? So he breaks down, you know, as much information, the first analytics guy, really. And he breaks down the whole, why you score goals or how you score goals. And he says, his analysis anyway, concludes that you need three passes or less. So this is what the English were doing. They were barreling through trying to score. And then what's the fatal flaw in his argument, however?
Yeah. It's a guy who was passionate about soccer and he literally had a miner's helmet with a flashlight on attached to it. He would take notes in his own shorthand, watching hundreds of games. And he found, okay, yeah, more goals happen when there's three or fewer passes. Therefore, passing is a waste of time. Just get the ball up and hope for chaos and that kind of thing. And it wasn't until really pretty recently, people went back through his math and realized it was wrong. He got the basic equations wrong. And it turns out that you do score. Possession does help score, especially according to his own data.
Right, because the average soccer possession is three passes or less.
Yes, exactly. And he was, you know, very well-meaning and extremely influential. And there's, I mean, people have traced sort of a long period of kind of caveman long ball tactics in England to this one guy who, you know, had bad math.
Yeah. And I was reading that. And I'm like, oh, okay. You go back to the movie Hoosiers, Gene Hackman, he plays Norman Dale and he's like four passes before you shoot. And it's like, all right, he had it figured out, or, you know, they had it figured out in basketball, you know, Norman Dale anyway, had it figured out in the movies, because the more you move it around, you get better opportunities.
Yeah, but soccer also is, you know, that's still a question that's up for debate. It's crazy to think because someone like Jose Mourinho just today was announced as the new manager of Real Madrid. He's returning to Real Madrid. He said, he who has ball has the ball has fear. You know, his teams have historically sat back more and let the other team have possession. And then when they make a mistake, hopefully they make it in a bad position for them and you can pounce on it. Whereas someone like Pep Guardiola, Manchester City legendary manager, he loves to have as much of the ball as possible and pass it around. Because soccer is such an imperfect game that there is no perfect way to play it.
Yeah, you talk about that too. But Skinner, I think it was.
Yeah, he's a former NASA scientist who doesn't like soccer.
Right. He was saying it was an imperfect game. Like,
he has a beautiful turn of phrase. He wrote a full peer-reviewed study because he got in a little bit of an argument with some friends at work. And he said, why do you care so much about the World Cup? The results are largely random. And he did an extensive study, and he found that because scoring is so, you know, relatively rare in soccer, that the results are more random than you'd like. The best team doesn't always win. He basically proved that in this paper, and one of the peer reviewers asked him sort of the question that defines, I think, all of the sports was, yeah, it doesn't reflect maybe who should have won, but that's not always the point. You know, the point is what happens in the game. The fact that the best team doesn't always win is the most, to me, natural human thing about soccer.
Yeah, and that's a weird thing coming from the American perspective. It's like, we want the best team to win. We want the winners. We want results that should happen or probably should happen. And, you know, the soccer, the, you know, people appreciate it for different reasons. And that's what I got out of this book that I didn't quite understand about soccer culture. It's like the playing of the game is just as important as the result in many cases. Now, when you get to the World Cup, it is nationalism, it is pride, it is all of that, but like, as you said, the best team doesn't always win. I think it's like, what, 28% chance?
His number using data from World Cups was, you know, it's more complicated than I can get into at the moment, but it was around that. And it's funny because this is why I think it helps for people to pick a favorite team, you know, to start following, because there's no better feeling that when your team is getting destroyed during an entire game and you still win. You defy fate, you defy the parameters of the game itself to get a result. And it's something that, again, this is a completely imperfect, scattershot, oftentimes random sport, but I think that's what makes it so fun.
Yeah. So let me ask, as a voice of the common American, I guess, that, you know, raised on baseball, basketball, football, and hockey and stuff like that, how do you pick a European team to follow or another country to follow in the World Cup that's not your own? Because, you know, coming from the United States, it's like, all right, well, I follow the Red Sox because, you know, my family's from Boston. And I follow the Blazers because I grew up in Portland. And, you know, like, how do you, you know, I follow the, you know, whatever other team because my dad liked them. Like, how do you do that in soccer?
There is no good way to do it. My advice would be to watch a few games, and if there's a team that, you know, plays in a particularly entertaining way to you or has players that you find compelling or fun to watch, that, you know, pick them. It's funny because you'll pick a team with a certain playing style, and then, you know, 3 years later they'll get totally new players and new manager, and you're stuck with a team that's completely different. But hey, that's part of it. And with the World Cup, you know, so especially this year where it's 48 teams and it used to be 32, there's so many teams that, gosh, I've never watched play, really.
They don't play that much together anyway.
No, they don't. And international soccer is, I'd say, in my opinion, a lesser product than club soccer, because, as you mentioned, you know, those players are picked specifically. They play together for, you know, long time. They practice together. They're more in sync. Whereas international, it's kind of, okay, we get together every couple months to play one game, and then in the World Cup we get together and are expected to be in sync again. But, you know, you'll find, you know, the last European Championships, I didn't know too much, you know, about Austria going in, watched a couple of their games and said, okay, this is a team I like watching. And so I was pulling for Austria in the last European championships. There'll be lots of stories like that and teams like that this year.
My nine-year-old likes to watch YouTube, and like, it's a constant thing on YouTube. Messi or Ronaldo. It's like, he's like, who do you like? Who do you like, Messi or Ronaldo? I'm like, I don't know. I think they're both great. I don't know. I don't know enough to say one way or the other, but you have a little study in the book about a little bit about Messi, and he like walks around the field. You know, and when you describe that, not knowing, you know, much of the intricacies about soccer, I was thinking like, he's kind of the Gretzky of soccer, just trying to find a
undersized.
Spot. Yeah. Undersized, trying to find a spot where he can come in and be as much impact. And he's moving away from, well, Gretzky away from the puck. He's moving away from the ball to the ball away, you know, in space. And is that the genius of Messi? And,
you know, it's one of a gazillion things there. And that was in the chapter, because I find advanced analytics and excuse me, in soccer fascinating, because it's so allergic to analytics. You know, there's no stoppages in time. There's no segmented periods you can sort of divide into the sport. It basically was, it couldn't even be pursued by analytics until the development of motion capture, motion tracking technologies. And this was one study that was used on how players sort of manipulate space. And anyone who watches a lot of soccer will, you know, this was well known that Messi walks a lot. He runs less than his teammates. And there's lots of conversation. Is he lazy? Is he just conserving energy? Whatever his reasoning behind is, the scientists who did this study, one of them who I spoke with, you know, because he is so good and dangerous and potent with the ball, that his presence anywhere on the field demands attention, and he can sort of change the gravity of the field just by being there. And he can, they found that he does more by walking through space than other players do by sprinting. And again, it's not because he walks. I think it's because of everything else he does that he can sort of short circuit defenses like that.
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting thing, the analytics discussion. And I know like Billy Beane, of Moneyball fame, and he co-owns a soccer team, or at least one, but with a guy you interviewed for the book.
Yes, a guy who wasn't a big sports guy. He was a motion. He did motion studies. He was a scientist who was specialized in motion. He tracked weather patterns and bison migration, stuff like that. And he got into sports and soccer specifically because he said, "Oh, this is the kind of data that I've been looking at. This is the kind of stuff I do." And soccer just has so many questions and uncertainties and fun stuff for scientists to get into.
So I guess the last question I got for you before we have to go here, as far as that goes, analytics and all that stuff, I worry about it in some sports. So you mentioned basketball, and you have a whole book on basketball. Baseball is going down that road, or has gone down that road probably more than anything. I talk about optimization of life and, you know, time management and all that stuff. And it's at a certain point, we can't optimize everything in our life because it's just not worth it. It takes the joy out of things. So what, as far as soccer goes, are you worried about this analytics trend, or will it make it better? Or is that still a question to be answered?
I'm not too worried because, you know, as I mentioned, soccer is such an imperfect, messy game that it can sort of resist that kind of approach. And it's funny you mentioned the sort of optimization and marginal gains. As I was part of the book, I went to England, and I wound up getting a sort of informal tour of Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, and they were telling me that the showers, if you notice in the showers, there's no control for temperature, and the manager is the one who controls the temperature. So, you know, they have to earn a hot shower, and the person who was telling me about this was like, yeah, this is the kind of marginal gains and optimization that you gotta, you know, in the modern game, you gotta find out. And I'm thinking, like, shower temperature has nothing to do with what's going on in the field. But soccer, you know, there's so much money involved, and there's, you know, it's obviously such a huge deal that people are searching for optimization in some pretty funny places that I don't think are gonna have a real actual difference on how the game is played.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry. One last question. Can we optimize for the big kid that toe punches? Can we optimize that?
That's a whole other thing that I don't even get into in the book. But a lot of very smart people who are kind of studying and tracking American youth soccer point to that is that the fact that, okay, the way we're playing it is
they dominate at the youth level because they're big and you don't know where the ball is going.
Yeah, and teams only care about winning and losing. So what they do is you boot it up to the big guy and they score a goal, and that this is actually our players are suffering because of this. Because, you know, in the best youth academies in Europe and around the world, they don't even care about the score. They don't play with goals for a while. They do technique, learning tactics and all the different skills and developing those. And then eventually when people grow and you get into your bodies and you can use those, you know, depending on your size and speed and athletic ability. Versus in America, which people think, you know, players aren't learning how to play soccer. They're learning how to be battering rams and kick the ball to the battering ram.
Yeah. So Shaq could have been a great soccer player if he learned how to toe punch better, probably. So
I don't know about that. But you know what? I would love to see him try.
Yeah. All right, Nick, this has been great. Appreciate your time. Best of luck with the book. It's How to Watch Soccer Like a Genius, What Architects, Stuntwomen, Paleoanthropologists, and Computer Scientists Reveal About the World's Game. And that was released by Abrams Press March 12th.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. It was a pleasure talking with you.
All right. Thanks, Nick. Appreciate
Take
it.
Care.
Hey, folks, if you've enjoyed today's deep dive about soccer and love looking at the sports world from unexpected angles, you're going to want to go over and check out our Substack. It's called Unrelenting, the O'Leary Review. I call it a relentless defense of the permanent things in our culture. And we draw blood from the cosmopolitan elites who are eager to sanitize our history. That being said, we're your voice. I call it the voice of the forgotten American. You can find us at O'LearyReview.com. Over there, we talk sports, and we do more than that. We talk culture and all sorts of things. But as far as sports go, we don't recap the box scores from last weekend or give you a breakdown of the Sabres game or whatever the Red Sox did last night. That's for the beat writers in their own cities. But what we do is we use the discussion of athletics and sporting tradition to help reverse the managed decline that the cultural elites have in mind for all of us. We explore the hidden mechanics of sports and culture. So what lessons can you take away from sports and history, particularly when they intertwine? How do they apply to today's chaotic world? To get the full experience, you want to join our paid tier. And we call that the Junto. It's $14.99 a month, or $100 a year. And when you upgrade to that paid subscription on Substack, you'll get the exclusive access to our premium essays, bonus podcast episodes, and you'll also become part of the community of fellow curious minds who want to see the game differently. It also helps us keep producing more podcasts like this, where you'll get the angles that you never hear from the corporate press. So stop watching sports like everyone else. Head over to the link in the show notes, hit subscribe, join our community of geniuses like you today. Once again, that's O'LearyReview.com.